Welcome to the Casual Temple Podcast, episode 28, and I'm your host, Miralee Duffy. At the Casual Temple, our mission is to discover our connection to the unseen world of spirit and how that empowers us to know our true selves. But before we start, a little favor, please review and rate the Casual Temple on your favorite podcast platform. Today, I'm so excited to have Nick, also known as Die Spukenkika, on the show today. Nick is a Silesian German folk magic practitioner who has also been on an incredible journey of self-discovery, exploring folklore, witchcraft, and connecting with spirits. Raised in Northwest Germany, Nick's childhood was steeped in their grandparents' stories and the rich local environment. Despite growing up queer in a conservative setting, these influences led Nick to the online witchcraft community, where they realized that their family practices were essentially folk magic. We also learn about Nick's research into the displacement of the Silesian people and its impact on the community, land, and their descendants. I learned so much from Nick, so definitely stay tuned to the Casual Temple, where learning is fun and mental. Welcome to the Casual Temple. This week, we're joined by Nick, also known as Die Spukenkika, who is a Silesian German folk magic practitioner living in Northwest Germany. Nick has a Patreon, which mostly focuses on their craft, the folklore of their culture, and just general witchiness. Die Spukenkika also has a wonderful YouTube channel, which I recommend highly, highly checking out. Nick, welcome to the Casual Temple.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, gosh. Well, we're just going to kind of jump right in, as we usually do. So can we start with sort of learning more about you and where you're coming from and how you are where you're at? So was there a moment or moments in your life that kind of led you to where you are that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, so there kind of have been multiple smaller instances that kind of nudged me into the direction that I'm going now. So there wasn't this like one big huge event that kind of changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that what informs my perspective, both as a practitioner, but also as like just a person, is the ties to my culture and the way that I was raised in it. So for everyone that doesn't know me, I am from Northwestern Germany, born and raised and live here. So I'm very like, I've got deep roots here in this place. And I was like, as a child, very influenced by the stories and folklore that my grandparents told me. And they often brought me along trips throughout the countryside around my village where I live and showed me different places in nature and kind of explained the folklore that was connected to them and also taught me a bit about local herbs that grew there and stuff like that. And that quickly spiraled into me having a fascination with like folklore and folk history and all of that at a very young age. However, I did not really categorize it as culture at that point. It was just like fancy things that people around me told me. So that only became a later revelation when I really delved into witchcraft, actually, that the things that I was taught were folk magic, essentially. And this, you can kind of already see how these few instances kind of shaped my path in a way. So we start with getting taught these folk practices, but not realizing that this is actually folk magic. And then later figuring out that witchcraft even is a thing and that there's this whole entire community out there online that talks about this kind of stuff. And then making the connection later on between the things that I was taught growing up and witchcraft. And this kind of led me to really throwing myself into the study of my local folk magic. And another big thing here for me is that, and I feel like a lot of people who grew up rurally will relate to this, that the countryside is not the most accepting place, let's say. There are oftentimes a lot of more conservative people around here.
Right.
And is growing up queer in this kind of environment also leaves its mark, sort of. And that kind of then later on also informed the way that I kind of perceive the world and the things that I care about. And I can't even imagine what my life would have been like if I like wasn't queer or did not grow up in this environment, because these things really shape like essentially the core of who I am as a person.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot to go through. I definitely can relate.
I currently live in Seattle, but my parents had moved us out north of Seattle, closer to Canada, actually, in Washington State. And it was very rural, and it was a big adjustment because we came from the city to the, and you're just like, wow, people have a different way of thinking around here that I don't know if I'm down with, but that's okay. So thanks for sharing that. Oh, and I love that you started with sharing how, you know, it kind of came with your grandparents telling you stories, and maybe like maybe I'm assuming kind of like folktale slash fairy tale kind of things. Cool. And I know in one of your videos you kind of talked about that with sort of people maybe who are trying, like maybe let's say German American, American German, that has been kind of removed a few generations from Germany. Like one of the places to start maybe is even just, I think you said like Grimm's fairy tales or the fairy tales even, if I recall. So in saying that, because I think most people probably are familiar with Grimm's fairy tales. Is there one of the story, not necessarily just the Grimm's fairy tales, but that what your grandparents did tell you that like really resonated with you, or a specific tale or story?
Yeah, so there are basically too many to count, but
Right.
I really want to highlight the distinction between fairy tales and folklore, because I
Oh,
was personally more
yes.
attracted to folklore. So when you go through the Grimm's fairy tales, for example, they are more or less unspecific. So they take place once upon a time in a land far, far away. So they are removed sort of from local culture, whereas fairy tale, whereas folklore often has a very specific time and place that it is attached to. And this was what mostly kind of inspired me as a child, because I could go to the places that the folklore talks about, and there was a sort of relevance to these tales that I was told. And I could, they were more tangible to me, let's just say, because fairy tales are more like stories generally about the human condition, about
Right.
morality, about how to go about life. Folklore is made by a specific community in a specific place for that community. And the teachings and knowledge passed down in the folklore is also very specific to that community. And this is what really influenced me most, I feel like, because that is another aspect that led me to developing these strong roots in this place. And just to give you an example, we have a lot of bogs around here and a lot of wetlands, because northwestern Germany is generally constantly getting hit with like the wet air from the North Sea. So it's always cold, always wet, lots of rain, overcast skies, kind of like how I imagine Seattle to be honest. And because of this climate and because of the conditions of our soil, there are a lot of underground water deposits all around in specific areas. And sometimes these can break in and swallow up the ground that is above. So if you build your house in these areas, there's a chance that it might one day just randomly get swallowed up by the earth. And our folklore here kind of incorporates this theme that specific places are kind of like cursed with the wrath of God or something similar like that. So this really, this natural disaster-prone area has been kind of mythologized over time, and the knowledge that specific areas are dangerous to build your house on are incorporated into folklore and then passed on throughout the generations so that this information is being remembered. And this is just one example of how I kind of experienced the folklore here and constantly kind of blown away by the amount of intricate knowledge that exists within it.
Wow, thank you. Yeah, thank you for explaining the difference between the two of like fairy tale and folklore and what was captured in probably Grimm's fairy tales and how it relates to you. That's really cool. And now I'm thinking about it, not to get into like a weird, but there have been landslides here in Washington State, and probably for the most part, people not even considering, even though it seems kind of logical that because of all the rain and melting snow that we get, that would happen a lot. But it seems like, you know, people are very surprised and that, you know, and then And it's unfortunate because then, you know, people are in the path of where that's going to happen. But because we haven't, you know, settled this area or been in this area very long, we don't know those tales. Kind of like what you're talking about of like, you know, this kind of happens. Maybe you need to prepare for it. So it's really interesting. Wow.
Yeah, I bet the indigenous people in the area where you live have like stories and knowledge about these things.
100%. Yes. Probably mostly why they're like, we want to have our places in certain areas and not be shunted into the area you choose. Yeah, that's very cool. So would you say that, I mean, it did, you kind of did layer that into how sort of that upbringing helps you see the current world that you're in. Would you say that experience kind of affected you going forward as a child and then, you know, on to becoming an adult of having the tales happen and you're like, oh, this seems like it's magic. You know, where did that all kind of fold into?
Oh, well, for a long time, I did not like not push it away, but didn't pay any mind to it, really. It only was later when I actually got introduced to the online witchcraft community that I started delving deeper into that, and I kind of found my joy in research again, and because of that, now I'm pursuing like academic degrees at university that kind of have to do with that. So, for example, I study both, it's called cultural and social anthropology. And then in my second like field of study, I study Central European archaeology. And these are two things which are very much connected to my upbringing, which is very like about land connectedness and really taking a look at how cultures over time interacted with the land. And and one day I hope to actually be able to pursue a career in this field, of course. And even my like online persona, sort of, or the content that I share online is also about this. So I would say that the ways in which the knowledge of folklore and the interaction with culture here have shaped me are really in every aspect of my adult life now.
Yeah, for sure. That's really cool that you were able to find sort of an area of study and like just regular academic study that would relate to your very strong interest in this area. So that's really cool. I'm so glad that you found that for yourself. What would you say were some, you know, you talked about kind of getting into the witchcraft community, but what were some favorite, well, actually, sorry, let me back up, actually. Did you have any support or guidance with your experience? Like, sound like you had maybe your family was a little bit supportive, maybe not in the witchy stuff, but I don't know.
Yeah. So I guess my family, well, it depends. Some people in my family are very much pro this stuff and are very much interacting with the witchcraft sphere in some ways. Other parts of my family are just like retelling the folklore, and some parts of my family don't want anything to do with it. And generally, they just, don't really care about what I do. So, at least it's not downright criticizing everything that I do. So, I guess that's something good. But in ways of support, it's kind of a tough one because it depends on how you define support. Like, my grandparents still teach me some of these practices, so that's support in a kind of way, but they don't do it under the guise of I'm passing this ancient witchy tradition on to you now. They just do it because they feel like it or I asked. Yeah, and definitely going back to the stuff that I was saying, the other aspect that shaped me growing up queer here, I did have support in the form of friends in that respect. And that also kind of like shaped me in the way that I realized that my immediate relatives weren't necessarily always the people that I could or should look for in support, but that I could also rely on other people outside of my family who would be there for me.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point. 'Cause I'm making, as you're talking about that, it's making me think of sort of the friends I had in their high school or outside of high school, a young adult growing up. And yeah, a lot of times it's, people from the queer, gay, lesbian communities are always very much relying on their friends, right? Because their parents weren't getting it yet. So that's cool. Yeah. That makes sense that you would have the support of your friends. And then at least, with your family, they're not kind of getting on you about the witchy stuff. So I think that's supportive. Oh man. So what were some of your, did you have any favorite books that you're reading? Kind of along those lines that you, I'm sure you do, but
I prepared for this.
I bet you did.
So,
Yep.
lots of these books are very, very specific about my path. So they might not be applicable to most people. So one thing that really shaped me was this book, which I mean, the German title is Die schönsten deutschen Volks- und Heldensagen, which in English would be like the most beautiful German folk tales and tales of heroes, something along those lines. And this book is actually quite old. It's, I think, from the 70s roundabout, and it contains the Nibelungensage, which is a, how do I explain, an ancient medieval epic, sort of. And if you look at the Norse Eddas, for example, parts of the Nibelungensage are also represented in there because it goes that way back, that far back. And that also means that it was likely told in some version during the pagan times in Germany as well. And this is just, I feel like, an almost essential read if you're interested in anything to do with Germanic paganism or German folk magic, because there are a lot of mythological themes which pop up in the stories that are relevant, in my opinion. And I was so lucky that this book kind of compiles all of these stories into one. I don't think they produce this anymore, but well.
That's cool you have it though.
And another book, which is most definitely out of print by now, is something that is called like folk culture in the Tecklenburger Land, which the Tecklenburger Land is like a micro region within northwestern Germany that is kind of sort of in my area. And this book was made in the 1960s and basically compiles a lot of folk customs and folk stories from my area. And this is sort of my holy grail in a way, because this talks about everything culture-wise that I'm interested in, how traditional crafts work, how traditional stories are told, and what wedding practices traditionally looked like in my region. What did wedding gowns look like? Spoiler, they weren't white, by the way. And this is just a treasure trove of information, I feel like. And now we get also into stuff like Germania by Tacitus, which is like a which is also available in English for everyone interested. This is basically a book written by a Roman historian who interacted with, or not directly interacted with, but interacted with people who interacted with the Germanic tribes around like the first century CE, I believe. And this is just a very interesting read if you want to know more about the Germanic pagans around that time specifically. And because of the same reason, also Beowulf, which is also a pagan-esque tale, which has some Christian influences, but is still interesting. And now we get to stuff about Silesia, which you also mentioned in the intro, that is also part of my family history, sort of. So, for everyone who is unaware, Silesia is a region in southern Poland, in the north of the Czech Republic and in the very east of Germany. And a lot of German-speaking peoples there were expelled after World War II in some very horrific and gruesome ways, which I won't get into. But part of that history also is that Polish speaking peoples, which lived in areas which are now in modern day Ukraine and Belarus, also got taken from their homes and then placed into the now empty buildings and towns in Silesia, which was previously inhabited by many German-speaking peoples. And this book, German title is In den Häusern der Anderen, the Polish title is Poniemieckie, talks about the perspective of the new Polish arrivals in Silesia and what struggles they had and how they tried to connect to this foreign land that they suddenly found themselves on, which they didn't really have any real ties to, and painful history that comes with that. So even though this isn't overtly witchy, it still really shaped the way in which I go about learning about my specific Silesian practice. And the last book on here, also available in English, basically just available in English, is The Nordic Animist Year by Rune Janø Rasmussen, who is a Danish scholar of the religion, the history of religion, who basically compiled a bunch of traditional folk holidays from around Northern Europe and also parts of Central Europe. And he talks basically about how these seemingly overtly Christian practices still have some animist and pagan roots, and how they are observed in a seasonal cycle that helps local communities to sort of better become a part of the seasonal cycles within the environment that they find themselves in. So I could go on and on with how many books I have, but these are just some of the highlights. I also have a couple of videos, I believe, on my channel where I go more into depth into my book recommendations. So anyone who's curious about that can hop over there and watch them.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It gave me like as you're describing the books, it was giving me like a nice kind of through line of kind of where who you are and where you're at. And like really good recommendations too. And I'm like, oh yeah, Tacitus. I feel like that has been referenced in a lot of books I've read as well. Those Romans are always documenting in their craft, getting into other cultures. So that's pretty funny. Oh gosh. There's something, oh, yeah. There's something about the yeah how you were explaining the Silesian or the
Silesian, yeah.
Silesian, that was like super interesting. I didn't know that that history and wow, I just learned something new and wow, and I can see how that would be something you would want to learn about because that sort of energy of displacement, I'm sure kind of lives in like present day in some form,
Yeah. I mean, this is just a really like perfect part of history that I actually got to study through my university, in
Oh,
which I
cool.
interviewed both family members who directly experienced this expulsion and also their descendants and other people outside of my family as well. And I feel like it was really shocking to witness this sort of violent disruption between the ties of a people and the land that they're on. Like me as an animist, my heart bleeds sort of. And even generations down the line, this was also very apparent in my research. Even people who were born after the expulsion in the sort of new land that the people now found themselves in still carried this sort of pain with them. And oftentimes they also experienced some form of discrimination from the Germans because they were sort of the refugees and were kind of looked down on.
Ooh, yeah, that is definitely like a heavy subject to look into, but my goodness. Yeah, I'm only relating in the fact that my dad is Irish American, and while they weren't forcibly expunged from Ireland, it was a matter of like, the poverty and, people had to leave, and I definitely see that the repercussions of that in our current sort of family DNA. So, wow, that's so cool that you get to look into it and like interview people and interview your family. Wow, what a gift.
Actually, the Polish folk witch who you had on your channel, she actually lives in Silesia now.
Oh,
And
wow.
I got to have this amazing talk with her on my channel about our different perspective, sort of. She, as someone who lives in Slesia now, and me, as someone who had family there, which got expelled. And our two perspectives kind of formed two pieces of this puzzle. And it was
Oof.
really amazing to be able to connect with her in that way.
Yeah, I did see that on your channel. I definitely, everybody should check it out because I was going to check it out before I ran out of time. But yeah, Joanna is amazing. So I'm glad that you were able to have such a really cool conversation. Wow, I'm so excited. I'm gonna definitely look at that. Okay, well, thank you for giving us this nice picture of you and everything. So what would you say, as a German folk magic practitioner, what is your day-to-day kind of practice, or how do you like have that in your kind of day-to-day life? How does that work for you?
I guess some people might imagine something very elaborate when they see like witches online, sort of. But to be honest, my practice is very like mundane in a way that it weaves itself sort of through my day-to-day life without making a bunch of spectacles, sort of. So one thing that I always do is at nightfall when I like go to bed, I do a quick prayer to my ancestors and thank them for watching over me and protecting me to kind of keep the line of connection open, to do something to connect with them. And the benefit of that is that I can do that fairly quickly. It can be just a quick little prayer and that I can like build on if I feel it necessary. So if I want to string them along for a ritual that I'm doing, for example, I want to do some divination with them, I might light a candle, and if I want to go a step further, I might give them an offering in the form of tea or something from their traditional cultural cuisine, for example. And other than that, another thing that really gets like, I feel like, overlooked in the witchcraft community, if you are a folk magic practitioner, your practice also involves things which might look very mundane and not witchy to most people. So let me grab this example.
Sure.
I actually made an Instagram post about this very recently, but this is basically a flute made out of a willow branch. And this is called Flötpiepen in Low Saxon, which is a minority language in my area. So it's not German, it's distinct from German. Actually, it's more closely related to English than it is to German. And this tool is something that represents sort of the first like instruments that humans in this part of the world were able to make, because all you need to create this fruit is basically a willow branch and a knife, and that's it. So it's very practical in the way, and this tradition has more or less been sort of lost, quote unquote, in many parts of my area, but I recently got my grandfather to teach me how to make this. And this is also a part of my practice, which involves like uncovering these old traditions. And even though it might not be overtly witchy, it's still part in connecting to the land and the seasonal cycles, because you can only make these flutes in spring when the sap is rising and the wood becomes more malleable. So this automatically ties you both to the landscape, because you're probably going to use a local willow, and to the season, because you need to pay attention when the wood is basically good for you to use. And on top of that, you're engaging with an ancient ancestral tradition, which is where the ancestor worship part comes in. So taking care of these traditions and passing them on to others is also a big part of my practice, I'd say.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Never considered that, but that's a good point. It's like you're kind of uncovering sort of these folk practices. But they're kind of inherent, like, they're kind of connected to the land and that and the spirits of the land, I'm sure. And so that, yeah, that makes sense that it would kind of just inherently sort of be witchy in its own way.
Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is how you engage with the tree that you're taking the wood from, because you need to build a connection. And
Right.
here in northern Germany, we have a thing called Kopfwiehen in Low Saxon. In English, it's like called hollowed willows. I don't know if that's a term that you know, but basically, you cut the top parts of the branches of the willow off, and do that over a prolonged period of time until there are like these knotty heads building on top of the willow where a bunch of smaller, thinner branches will spring from. But they are very like, what is the word? They are very, very close to each other, and these branches. And they are very good to use in crafts. So you can make fences out of them and you can make baskets out of them. And because these branches are so close together and malleable, wildlife often uses them to build nests in. So the interaction with this tree and the changing of this tree both benefits the humans who take the wood and the wildlife who uses that as a nesting ground. And if you regularly interact with this tree, for example, through making fruit pipkes, you're going to sort of notice when you will need to like cut a few branches off again so that the top part doesn't become too heavy and like breaks apart the tree. So this is an important part of regional animism, which is a gear in the system of land connectedness that ensures that every sort of creature, the humans, the animals who use the willow tree itself, kind of thrive. And this is basically what folk traditions are all about, I think.
Oh, cool. What a cool example. Yeah, that was a really good illustration of that. I definitely have seen that because around here in Seattle, we have a lot of trees. But yeah, people will have to cut them probably because they kind of died at the top or whatever, exactly how you explained. And yeah, you do see kind of the like little trees coming out of the stump. So that's interesting. Yeah, and I like that you're kind of building this relationship with this tree. And then all the animals that are kind of visiting. That's a really cool picture. Love that. So my next question is sort of around, I hope this makes sense, but what is your experience of the accessibility of ancestors and land spirits? And I can elaborate if that wasn't clear.
Yeah, so I feel like it's going to be a bit different for everyone, but to me, the ancestors and land spirits are very accessible because I'm in a very fortunate position. I live in a village which my ancestors are buried, and I also am not a colonizer on this land. So I feel like the spirits would be more open to me than they would be, for example, in North America, if that makes sense. And through these folk tales, again, I keep coming back to this. There are also ways described in them how to interact with the land spirits. So you sort of have a cultural guidebook of what to do with your local land spirits, how to interact with them, what not to do, what to do, what offerings to give them, etc. So that makes them very accessible to me. And in my personal experience, both ancestors and land spirits are more kind than I imagined. Because in some folk tales, and especially online, these beings can often be painted as like very wrathful and very easy to anger if you fuck up a ritual or stuff like that. And I did have a lot of anxiety surrounding that initially, but in my experience, which su surprised me, they are very like forthcoming and forgiving. And they really will reach out a guiding hand in a way. So I've never been smited by any of the beings that I work with, which is good. They have been actually very helpful. So for me personally, they are very accessible. But I guess for other people in different parts of the world, under other circumstances, the same thing might not be true.
Yeah, that's a good point about sort of probably the reason why it was like either easy and or easy and sort of you got like an instant sort of oh it's not scary, it's kind of welcoming sort of feeling from these particular spirits is because of how you laid it out. Like your family has been there for generations, it's kind of you're very connected to the land. But I'm wondering like if you have a suggestion like for somebody who isn't connected to the land, and I know maybe that might be something you might not know how to answer, but especially somewhere in America where we're full of, it's like full of colonizers, full of people who were brought here. like, how would you even start? Like, you're connecting with the land, with, land spirits that aren't connected to your biology or your, I don't know if that, like, how would you even start?
Yeah, I'm myself, I am not sure because I
Right.
often have a very hard time getting into an American frame of mind because it's sort of foreign to me. And I feel like I cannot solve American problems. But if I were to take a guess, I'd say that approaching your First Nations would be a good start to find out whose land you're on, what are the people called, where are your the newest representatives of these people, what folk tales, if they're willing to share, do they have, what practices do they have, and kind of respectfully try to engage with the original inhabitants of this land first, who already knew all the stuff about land spirits there, and then to go off of that. This is my broad suggestion. Of course, take this with a mountain of salt because I am a European and I don't feel like I should be your first source to look at when trying to engage with your land spirits.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think your suggestion though is pretty sound personally. But that's just again from my own personal experience and thinking. But yeah. Yeah, definitely. And it's sort of what I've gotten too, because my ancestral spirits have asked me to connect with the spirits of the land where I'm at here in Seattle. And it's mainly the Duwamish Indian Nation, Native Nation here. So yeah, I have my plans of like working that all out. So that was interesting that at least your suggestion kind of lined up with that. But yeah, definitely connect with the native peoples and lands. Where you're at, America. Let's try that first. Okay, so, and I know you explained this on a couple of your videos, and you're really good at like kind of giving a nice explanation so you can kind of categorize these things. It's helpful for me. But what would you say, and I know this is kind of hard for you specifically, the differences between like ancestors, land spirits, and then house spirits, if there is even a difference. But
Yeah, if you look at folklore, things are very messy, at least in my area. The thing is that there are no direct hard borders between any of these categories. I mean, an ancestor isn't someone or isn't just someone who you're blood related to. Like, let's get that misconception out of the way first. Like, your ancestors can be people of the land who lived there before you, even though your ancestry is from somewhere else. Your ancestors could also be ancestors of practice. So, if you are a writer or a smith or what have you, people in that field who were very prevalent, for example, they could also be considered your ancestors. So, the term ancestor is a very wide idea. And land spirits, in a way, can also be ancestral spirits to you. I would say that most of them were never human. They are sort of the personifications of a place. And house spirits, I'd argue, are then the personifications of your home, or land spirits which go inhabit your home with you. And in our folklore, it's emphasized time and time again how important it is to have a reciprocal relationship with all of these. However, I also say that your ancestors who were human can sometimes become land spirits or even house spirits. Oftentimes, you'll find stories of the first person who built a home becoming then the house spirit after they pass, and then guiding the people who live in that home after them through hardships and stuff. And sometimes you will even have stories of like people marrying house spirits or land spirits, and then they would become the ancestors of the next generation, for example. So the terms are all very loose in a way, but you can kind of categorize them as sort of blobs of color with that sort of intermingle between them, and they are on a gradient and not like these heart boxes. I hope that
Right.
made sense.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful. I love how you explain that. Yeah. Wow, very cool. Yeah, it is sort of like these spirits or whatever. They kind of do sort of fit somewhere, but they, yeah, exactly. They kind of might bleed into other things. So that's really cool. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so my next question is mainly, and you explain things so beautifully. So I'm hoping you could explain this as well, but I come from, my practice currently is a hermetic practice, right? And it's very much sort of in my practice, it's balancing sort of the masculine and feminine energy. And that's just how, for me, it's just how my brain is organized and how it makes sense for me to do that. And I know you've explained that you approach your magic and your practice in a non-gendered way. Can you help us illuminate that? For
Yeah.
me and our audience.
If you are a medic practitioner or someone who's into like ceremonial magic, these things might sound bonkers to you. But for me, as a folk magic practitioner, approaching magic in a non-gendered way very much makes sense because the spirits that I work with in folklore aren't gendered in the way that you might expect. They have sort of a cluster of different properties, all of which could not be sorted neatly into one or the other category. So they are more, again, on a gradient. Also, just for me personally, the concept that you often find in witchy circles of the divine masculine and feminine, for me, it doesn't hold up under scrutiny. And I might tread in some waters here that aren't necessarily like common to find in the witchy online circles, but I realize that this might be a hot take. For me, I just see the divine feminine, for example, as an amalgamation, as a sort of concentration of properties which are just stereotypically 1950s housewife-esque. So you have like, oh, the divine feminine is receptive and passive and nurturing and kind and soft. And she doesn't go to work really. She just takes care of the children. And then the divine masculine becomes this hyper aggressive, brutish, strong figure that just overpowers everything in a lot of these circles. And that for me quickly, I see it sliding into very like right-wing territory in a way. I don't know if you are on TikTok and have witnessed this trend, but there was this trend of embrace your divine feminine on TikTok, and it was basically just a bunch of trad wives trying to make like misogyny appealing to the young generation in the
Oh,
way
okay.
that they just talked about giving your how do you say, giving your, what's the English word? Fuck. Autonomy, that was the
Autonomy.
word.
Perfect. Yeah.
Giving your autonomy up to your husband to embrace your divine feminine so you can be your true divine self, sort of that route. And
Gotcha.
this is a very slippery slope that you start out with this gendered system, and then you kind of think about what is divine feminine and masculine to you, and you end up in these thought patterns that just basically replicate very harmful stereotypes that we have in
Right.
society. And that can very quickly lead into very bad territory politically wise, which is unfortunately very prevalent in our community. And specific groups of people will go after these people. They will harp on that. They will use
Yeah.
this as a gateway to open the door to these sort of harmful narratives. And this is just one reason why I don't personally vibe with this concept. And
Gotcha.
in German folk magic, you have like Frau Holle, who is both like allowed to be like sexy and erotic, and also can be an old ugly hag who eats your children, with that is basically the polar opposite of what
Right.
most people think of as divine feminine.
Yeah.
So this is basically my perspective.
Yeah, wow, cool. Yeah, that is really well explained. And I feel like in the example of, say, these people on TikTok, which, okay, yeah, I can't go on TikTok basically is what I'm hearing. But is that it just seems like, I don't know, like a strange way of approaching being an individual and a human being, and that's unfortunate. Yeah, I like how you explained sort of in your either working with spirits and then kind of looking at your own folk tales, it doesn't really make sense because they're not really living in those boxes. So yeah, thank you for walking us through that. That was awesome. Okay, and I know we're going to talk about your Patreon and sort of what you and your Patreons get up to. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so on my Patreon, I basically post about three blog posts each month. One small blog post for the lowest tier, and then as the tiers progress, you'll get like two bigger blog posts, and all of them are relating to German folk magic in some way. And my patrons get to vote on the topic that I cover, and some of them they also get to vote on video topics, for example. And each month, I'll also release a Patreon exclusive video in which I perhaps give some hot takes which aren't as welcome on YouTube. So my ideas about how I don't think that divine feminine and masculine are a thing would probably
Right.
fit into that category.
Gotcha.
Other than that, depending on the tier, patrons also get like a shout out in my YouTube videos and stuff. I want to make things a bit more interactive in the future. Patreon recently launched like a function in which you can have like chat rooms with your patrons. So
Cool.
if there's interest in my Patreon community specifically, I might consider doing like a test run with that. But also we are just talk in like comment sections under my post when people have like their own ideas and like comment on the work which I do, which I love, because you have this like really interesting amalgamation of people who come from different backgrounds but are all somehow related to the topic of German folk magic. So some people might have ancestry which is Volga German, and which is a Russian German minority, and they also have their practices, and then we kind of get to talk in the comments, for example. So this is really interesting. And yeah, if you want like regular content from me, the best way to get it is through Patreon, because I'm sort of busy with university right now.
Right.
So you might not get as much or as consistent free content from me on YouTube, which I hope to change in the coming future. But for now, most of my stuff will be on Patreon.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it sounds like you have a lot of really good offerings, and you're kind of extending sort of the, you're asking your Patreons like, hey, what topic should I cover? It's very interactive, and that's really cool. And I hope someday soon that you can have like a chat room so I could see that being really beneficial for people to kind of share knowledge and everything. So that's really cool. Now, so then my next question, it probably is very similar to what you have on your Patreon, but maybe different. Do you have any upcoming projects or events that you would like for us to know about?
Not necessarily. I mean, I always have something cooking in the background, but these things aren't like not quite ready yet to share. Again, I am very busy right now, which kind of puts a hold on this kind of hobby that I have on the internet. But if I could let people know one thing, it will probably be that the best way to keep up with me and to get these like quote unquote releases, I hate that word, but releases that I have would be on Instagram, because that's basically where I share most frequently updates in my life, and you can get like a notification whenever like something important comes up.
Cool. So, okay. So, yeah. So, that's definitely probably the best. Is that the best place to reach you? Is maybe on Instagram and your Patreon, most
Yeah.
likely? Okay.
Yeah, I'll regularly check my DMs. Although Instagram sometimes screws with the DMs somehow, so that
Yes.
I only see them a couple of days later. So if anyone right now is waiting on a message back from me, I'm so sorry. I'm really trying my best. I hope that Instagram will fix this issue in the future.
Yes, I've also run into this recently. So yes, everybody, it's okay. Yeah, we'll just be a little patient. No worries.
Yeah, if you want to make sure that I see your message, there is a tier on my Patreon where I give like personal help to people who want to do research into German folk magic, because for a lot of them, especially in the diaspora, it can be hard to get specific sort of information. So
Right.
I, with my perspective, then kind of try to help them out. So if you have any questions about German folk magic or how to reconnect or anything, and I haven't responded to it, haven't seen it, sort of, my Patreon is probably the best way to get a very quick response from me.
Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, so we're definitely wrapping it up. But are there some words of wisdom that you would like to leave us with today?
Yeah, let me just check my notes because I pondered this question a lot.
Right.
Yeah, so this goes back to what I was talking about previously with the way that humans kind of aren't separate from nature, and we actually play a role within it. If you think back on the example of the willow trees, that the humans cut to a specific length to use the wood in their crafts, and then the stuff that grows back is often used by animals for nesting. So this is sort of a reciprocal relationship. I feel like that shows that this narrative that often floats around the internet of humans are parasites on this earth and everything would be better without humans isn't actually true. Like, we play a really important role in the ecosystem, in my opinion, and we have a place here, definitely. I feel like this is just a misidentification of the true problem, that it isn't us, it isn't humans in general. I feel like the real problem is the disconnection that often results from us building systems in society that aren't beneficial to most, perhaps just a small percentage of people. So to anyone who might have this idea, who anyone who harbors the idea that the world would be better off without humans, I'd say, respectfully, you're wrong. And I really implore anyone to, even if folk magic isn't your thing, just have a light research and try to find out what your culture traditionally did to connect to the landscape that they're on. And you'll find a treasure trove of how to connect with nature or your landscape in a way which isn't as harmful as you might see today. And perhaps then you realize that we really aren't the issue. It's just, well, the capitalists, basically.
Oh, wow. Wonderfully said. I couldn't agree more. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Nick. I really enjoyed our time together
Me
today.
too.
Yes, thank you so much.
I feel like my brain grew two sizes after having Nick, Die Spukenkika, on the show today. Do check out the show notes for Nick's Linktree, and definitely take a look at their Patreon and Instagram. Do remember to like, follow, and subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us grow. Thank you for listening and being an important part of the Casual Temple.